The five Dakinis then prostrated themselves before the children and circumambulated him seven times. They offered him a mandala made of precious stone, praised his body, world, mind and merits, and finally made him the supreme bliss void, offering of the wisdom of four blisses produced through the ecstasy of union. Then they said, "Your instructions on the Pardo are clear and comprehensive."
You need to do something much in advance then. There's no connection down there. No, just too late to discuss. And finally made him the supreme bliss void, offering of the wisdom of four blisses produced through the ecstasy of union. And then they said, "Your instructions on the Pardo are clear and comprehensive. Now please give us the pith of this teaching to make it easier for us to practice." And they sang the following song. And then the Jitun Milarepa continued, "Fair ladies, driven by the three desires and flowing thoughts, sentient beings have been wandering down the endless road in the three realms, forever subjected to the eight deprivations. This journey is so long and hazardous that one feels very weary and exhausted. There are three different kinds of travelers on this road. The first have received, followed and practiced the instructions. The second have also received but have not practiced them, while the third have not even the instructions. The first kind do not fear or worry about the dangers of the road, nor about the traps of demons, because by practicing the Dharma they are able to vanquish all these fears. The third kind are ordinary people who spontaneously enter the perilous path and are automatically seized by the devils of karma, and they will undergo all the pains of birth and death and wander in the three realms of samsara before. The second kind have the same fears and hazards as the third, but they have received the instructions and have learned to recognize and fight against evil influences and so if they have an unshakable faith towards Buddha and an understanding and discretion for the Dharma, together with the armor of unyielding diligence, they may slowly and gradually recognize the three kaya of Buddha by observing carefully how the senses and elements subside at the time of death. You ask me about the teaching of realizing the three kaya. You should know that at the time of death, when the outer and inner elements successively subside, the consciousness of the dying man will be temporarily set free from the sting of afflictive emotions. The absolute reality, the essence of voidness of Dharmadhatu, beyond all thought, will unfold itself, shining bright as the sun and moon in the sky. This is the light of death, or the Dharmakaya itself. One should recognize it as it is, but do not do so at the time of death. A man must first understand the nature of mind in the way his guru pointed out during his lifetime, and also practice the illuminating light of the path. In the perilous path of the Sipa Pardo, the wanderer will be pursued and attacked by executioners who are in fact created by his own previous karmas and thoughts. From this mind created body forms are luminous, their organs are complete, and they possess the miraculous powers of a mundane karmic nature, which include the ability to pass through material objects, telepathy and so forth. The Pardo body of this stage is in fact identical with the Sambhoga Kaya. At this time one should invoke the magic like two-in-one Buddha body to replace and purify the karmic part of the body created by habitual thoughts, and thus recognize the Sambhogakaya as it is. To recognize the Sambhogakaya in the Pardo stage, one should practice the arising yoga and clearly visualize the pattern Buddha's body during his lifetime, and also practice the dream yoga to to master the manifestation of the phantom body. At the final stage of the intermediate state, driven by the winds of karma and blindness and having no choice whatsoever, he searches for somewhere to incarnate. When he watches sex intercourse between his future mother and father, hate towards one and love towards the other rises in him. But if this time he can remember the peace instruction and enter the world bliss experience and remain there, then karmic and worldly thoughts will not arise again. When he intends to incarnate, he should think and observe that all he sees are manifestations of Nirmankaya Buddha and recognize the Nirmankaya as it is. Tsongkhapa in his song of experience says that by undertaking just one-pointed meditation, it has no capacity to uproot the root of cyclic existence. So therefore, today we have found this precious human life where we have this capacity to undertake profound spiritual Dharma practices. It is therefore not enough to waste one's life simply on the level of saying that I have heard something, that I have listened to something, that I meditated something. So that is our normal tendency, to just lead your life undertaking the usual superficial form of Dharma practices, that you attend some Dharma teaching, that you do a little bit of reading, that you do a little bit of meditation, and in this way you make some prayers, and then you aspire and expect that you achieve enlightenment. In the true sense, it is not possible to achieve enlightenment by undertaking such a luxurious way of Dharma practice. If you take the example of Milarepa, he achieved enlightenment through great hardship and practice, rigorous practice, and not through practice that is in tune with worldly way of life. And similarly, in the case of Khyutub Norsangyo, also, he spent 40 years in deep meditation and reflection. And similarly, it is because of this the great second Dalai Lama has mentioned that Khyutub Norsangyo also reached such a stage that if he make another few months attempt, he is definitely going to achieve all nations. And therefore, this is the past history of how people achieved enlightenment, how these great masters achieved enlightenment. And in our case, we end up undertaking a spiritual practice which is really the worldly way of life and not genuine practice. And another great master has also clearly mentioned that if you undertake such a luxurious way of spiritual practice, you will not be able to achieve enlightenment, and therefore it is extremely important for all of us to undertake a rigorous practice, as Tsongkhapa has mentioned, that it is through the reflection on renunciation, bodhicitta, and so forth, that you come to an understanding that unless I be freed from the conditioned suffering, there is no genuine long-lasting security for achieving enlightenment. So it is in this way you will not voluntarily follow the afflictive emotions, and based on your own personal experience, you should also understand the sufferings of other sentient beings. And in your case, just as you are unable to tolerate your personal suffering, similarly, the rest of sentient beings are also also disturbed by afflictive emotions, and therefore, and even in the case of the arhats who achieved higher states of realization, still they have not removed the obscuration to enlightenment. And in the case of the sarvakas and patiyakabulas, they are still confused with the solitary nirvana, solitary realization, and therefore you should develop this aspiration, how nice if all sentient beings achieve complete omniscience, complete enlightenment. And it is in this way that you should develop this bodhicitta, aspiring to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And this in fact is the main practice that we must undertake and we must undergo. And as far as this question of meditation on bodhicitta is concerned, there is really no need for you to observe a special meditative posture. You can meditate on it. You can meditate on it while sleeping, while walking, while talking, and so forth. And in the case of the deity yoga practice, you might sometimes develop the idea that if you observe certain correct posture, it will be effective and useful for you. But this is not the case in terms of meditating on bodhicitta. So therefore, that is the most important and hard practice. And in order to develop genuine bodhicitta, it must be developed through the support of wisdom, realizing emptiness. And in order to be able to eradicate the grasping of the self, one should directly perceive emptiness. And one of the most supporting factor for developing such a path is the assistance and the support of one-pointed meditation. And in our case, whatever practices that we do, like prayer and so forth, without one-pointed meditation, it's really difficult to achieve such one-pointed meditation. And in the case of a very elderly person, including myself, now we are probably too late, it is not so easy to achieve that state. And in the case of younger people, it's really important to try to achieve that one-pointed stabilization, one-pointed meditation, because whatever other practices that you do, like meditation on impermanence, meditation on bodhicitta and so forth, if your practice is supported by that one-pointed meditation, all your virtuous practices will be much more powerful, much more influential, and that will lead to more transformed state of mind. And therefore, however, if you rely only on the one-pointed meditation and think that that is all what you need, and if you see it as the most important hard practices, then that is also wrong. As Tsongkhapa says in this verse, that with the mere one-pointed meditation, it has no capacity to uproot the root of cycle existence. Because through one-pointed meditation, even if you reach the peak of cycle existence, still you have not removed self-grasping, and therefore that path doesn't become a path that leads to the transcendental states. And also wisdom that is devoid of kamabiding or one-pointed meditation, however much you analyze, it will not be possible to develop genuine conviction. And therefore it is important to undertake a combined practice of the development of one-pointed meditation and wisdom realizing emptiness. So in this regard, it is really not enough just to develop some kind of understanding, but repeatedly relate it to your own mind and let your mind get totally habituated with such a meditation. And then a time will come when you will be able to really transform your mind. So it is of course very important to reflect on the view of emptiness. And as I said earlier, even if you are someone who say that I aspire to liberation, But in order to genuinely aspire liberation, you need to develop a clear understanding about the possibilities of possibilities of removing afflictive emotions in general. And through such an understanding, you will be able to see how it is possible to achieve liberation within oneself. And it is through such an understanding, you will also be able to develop the understanding how it is possible to achieve the nature truth body. And therefore, it is important to undertake a combined practice of kama abiding, especially insight, with the cultivation of bodhicitta, and then passing through various spiritual paths and grounds, and then finally achieving omniscience. Now, in order to be able to undertake such a practice, you should develop a clear understanding of the whole spiritual path that leads to enlightenment. You should be cognizant about the nature of the path, the classes of the path, the stages of the path, and so forth. And of course, the start has to be made from this very ordinary state. But mentally, if you are able to gain some assumption, some clear idea about how to proceed from this stage to the next stage and so forth, then your journey will be much reliable and your journey will be much safer. And therefore, it's important to gain a comprehensive idea about the whole spiritual path, whole spiritual classes. And therefore, it is important to listen to the teaching. And therefore, at this point, we are studying the great stages of the path to enlightenment by Tsongkhapa, which is the system and tradition of the fortunate beings, a tradition that comes from the Buddha through Maitreya and Manjushri, passing forth through successive masters to Atisha and then Tsongkhapa. And these great stages of the path to enlightenment by Tsongkhapa is really the king-like commentary out of all the commentaries on the stages of the path. And in terms of the main outlines, we have discussed about the greatness of the author, greatness of the teaching, and how to listen to such teaching and so forth. And in the next is how to guide students through proper instructions, that is relying on the spiritual teacher, and then how to extract the essence of human life. And that leads to the three stages of the path of the three individuals. And in the case of the path of the great individual, we discussed about generation bodhicitta and undertaking the practice of the six perfections. This actually has two divisions: the general process of practice and the specific practices. So the general practices of the six perfections in general, and particularly training in the last two perfections, kama abiding and special insight, which therefore can be categorized into two: training in kama abiding and training in special insight. And yesterday we studied about the kama abiding meditation, what are the preconditions necessary for kama abiding, and then the different objects of meditation. So yesterday we finished reading the topic on objects of meditation for purifying your behavior, and the next topic is objects of meditation for expertise. Now, with regards to objects of meditation for expertise, there are also five objects of meditation for expertise, namely expertise in the aggregates, the constituents, the sources, dependent arising, and what is and is not possible. So dependent arising here is in accordance with the Sharvaka Bhumi, and we are therefore here talking about dependent arising in the form of conditioned arising, and particularly the 12 links of dependent origination. So the aggregates are the five aggregates of form and others, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. Expertise in this is knowing that apart from these aggregates, the self and what pertains to the self do not exist. So in the case of the aggregates of form and so forth, when these aggregates are explained, we can identify this individual aggregates, but when you go on searching further, particularly with regard to the self, then you will find as if the self is hiding somewhere among these five psychophysical aggregates, and it's really not possible to for you clearly identify this self as we identify the other five psychophysical aggregates. So from that you should know, expertise in this is knowing that apart from these aggregates, the self and what pertains to the self do not exist. Now the constituents are the I and the others of the 18 constituents. Expertise in them is knowing the causal conditions by which those constituents arise from their own seats. So the I and the others of the 18 constituents, when you know how this I and the others of the 18 constituents function, how they arise, their causal conditions and so forth, how they arise from their own seeds, so that is gaining expertise on the constituents. The sources are the I and the others of the 12 sources, and expertise in this is knowing that the six internal sources are the dominant conditions for the six consciousness, that the six external sources are the object conditions, and that the mind which has just ceased is the immediately preceding conditions. So this is really knowing how they are momentarily changing, how they arise from their individual causes and seats and so forth. Independent arising is the 12 factors, and expertise in them is knowing that they are impermanent, suffering and devoid of self. So dependent arising, as I said earlier, is dependent arising in the forms of conditioned phenomena, the cause-effect relationship, and particularly the 12 factors. What is and is not possible refers to such things as it being possible for a pleasant fruition to arise from a virtuous action, but not possible for a pleasant fruition to arise from a non-virtuous action. Expertise in this is knowing that things are this way. This is a particular case of expertise in dependent arising. The difference is that you understand diverse causes. When you use these as objects of meditation for cultivating serenity, you keep your attention on just one of the perspectives in which the aggregates etc. may be known. Next is objects of meditation for purifying afflictions. Purifying affliction means either merely reducing the strength of the seeds of the afflictions or else utterly eradicating the seeds. In the former case, the objects of meditation are the comparative coarseness of each lower stage and comparative calmness of each higher stage, proceeding from the level of the desire realm up to the level of nothingness. In the latter case, the objects of meditation are impermanence and the other of the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. When you use these as objects of meditation for cultivating serenity, you do not analyze but instead keep your attention on any one cognition of an aspect of those objects that appears to it. Dhammalashila's second stages of meditation states the objects of meditation are three. After you have brought together everything that all 12 branches of scripture say about determining, settling into, and having settled into reality, you stabilize your mind upon it. Two, you observe the aggregates, etc., which includes phenomena to some extent. And three, you stabilize your mind on the physical form of the Buddha, which you have seen and heard about. So, as the Kamalashila second stage of meditation, when you meditate on impermanence and so forth, they do not teach directly on emptiness, but it will gradually lead to your mind settling into the meaning of selflessness. So that's the meaning of the first point. After you brought together everything that all 12 branches of scripture say about determining, settling into, and having settled into reality, you stabilize your mind upon it. Because you realize that since it is the nature of suffering, the root of suffering must be eliminated. Since all these realizations take place, it leads you to settling into, and having settled into reality means that you reflect on level of self-existence, and also from Madhyamika viewpoint, if you develop an understanding of the grosser level of the level of the existence of self, so then that also leads into understanding the subtle form of selflessness. And you stabilize your mind upon it refers to those topics of teaching which actually shows the meaning of the subtle selflessness, which directly teaches on the meaning of selflessness. So in short, these lines mean that all the teachings of the Buddha, which is actually condensed within the all 12 branches of scriptures, they all help you understand the subtle meaning of selflessness. And this is true because your ultimate aim is to achieve omniscience. And in order to achieve omniscience, the only way is to develop wisdom realizing the subtle emptiness. So it is in this way that all teachings either lead directly into it or lead indirectly into it. So in understand this, and then you should analyze it, and then let your mind stay on it. And second, you observe the aggregates, etc., which include phenomena to some extent. And third, you stabilize your mind on the physical form of the Buddha, which you've seen and heard about. And also by seeing the physical form of the Buddha, which you've seen and heard about, and then let your mind reflect on it. How do you stabilize your mind on things such as the aggregates? When you understand how all compositional things can be included within the five aggregates, you mentally collect them gradually into these five aggregates. Then you observe them and keep your attention on them. Just as discerning wisdom develops when you cultivate differentiation, so when you cultivate collectedness, you develop concentration, wherein your attention is brought together on the object of meditation without moving toward other objects. This is a personal instruction of the knowledge tradition. Likewise, when you understand how all phenomena can be included within the constituents and sources, you mentally collect them into these categories and keep your attention on this. Now, among these four types of objects of meditation, are purifying behavior, as explained. So, now these lines talk about the specific purposes of these objects of meditation. So, in the case of objects of meditation for purifying behavior, as explained, facilitate the stopping of attachment and such in those whose behavior is dominated by attachment and such. They are special objects of meditation because you may readily attain concentration based upon them. Objects of meditation for expertise are conducive to the development of the insight that knows emptiness, inasmuch as they refute a personal self that is not included among those phenomena. Therefore, they are excellent objects of meditation for cultivating serenity. Objects of meditation for dispelling afflictions serve as general antidotes to the afflictions, so they have great significance. The universal objects of meditation are not distinct from the aforementioned three. Therefore, since you must achieve concentration using an object of meditative serenity that has a particular purpose, those who achieve concentration using things like pebbles and twigs for objects of meditation are clearly ignorant of the teachings on objects of concentration. (Clears throat) And in fact, there are commentaries who say that you should observe, say, an object like a flower, first observe that through your sense consciousness, and then gradually engage in one-pointed meditation. And probably such meditations may be useful in the very beginning, and then gradually when your mind gets habituated, and then do not... Because the point is, in the beginning, when you use your sense consciousness and gaze at that object, and as the mental consciousness has this tendency to follow the sense consciousness, and then gradually when your mind is able to maintain one-pointedness on that object, then make sure that your sense consciousness does involve in it. So such kind of practices are there. But what is Tsongkhapa is saying here is that if you think that that kind of meditation alone is useful and as a very complete and correct one, then that is if you get confused only with that, it is wrong. There are those who suppose that if you focus on an object of meditation and keep your attention on it, this is an affirmation of science. They claim that meditation on emptiness means just stabilizing your mind without any basis, without focusing on any object of meditation. So there are, as Tsongkhapa says, there are some commentaries of Chakchen and Dzogchen, such teachings are there. So, and then Tsongkhapa says this is a total misunderstanding of how to meditate on emptiness, because now here what is important to understand is that there are many uninformed teachers, and that those uninformed teachers are found not only in the Mahamudra tradition or Dzogchen tradition, but it's found in all schools. As Changcha Rolpe Dorje has mentioned in his famous text called The Song of the Philosophical View, Recollecting the Mother, where he says that if you follow a wrong way of analysis, then there is a danger that the mother emptiness or mother wisdom understanding emptiness might run away. So therefore, I am not saying here that what is really correct is Gelugpa's view and what is wrong is Mahamudra or Dzogchen's view. And so just as... and also it is... So when I say that there are some small commentaries in Mahamudra and Dzogchen tradition who make such mistaken comments, so similarly there are minor commentaries by people who follow the Gelug tradition who also present such mistaken views. So by taking these minor commentaries, we cannot say that the Dzogchen view in general is wrong, Mahamudra view is in general wrong, Gelugpa's view in general is wrong. And in fact, as far as the main teachings by great masters like Tsongkhapa is concerned, if you compare some of these his commentaries to Chandrakirti and Nagarjuna's commentaries, the very style and method of writing and presentation, usage of words are almost similar. So we cannot say such views are wrong. But at the same time, it is important to understand the wrong views as wrong views. So if you have no consciousness at that time, then neither will you have a concentration that cultivates emptiness. On the other hand, if you have consciousness, then you are conscious of something. So you have to accept that there is an object of consciousness in terms of which consciousness is posited. And I normally tell people, and during one of my visit to America, one person who was from one center, it was at a time when there was a big earthquake in America, so And I asked one of these foreigner, American, saying that, did you get frightened when there was this earthquake? And then he answered by saying, no, when there was this earthquake, I had a great meditation on Dzogchen. So when he gave this answer, I felt probably he was mistaking the Dzogchen viewpoint to thoughtlessness. Of course, I am not an expert on Dzogchen, but I have read some of the commentaries. There I found that as a preliminary practice for Dzogchen practice, there is this practice of how, what is the source of the mind, how the mind abides, and where the mind goes. So there is this kind of analysis. And the wordings that you have used is the source of the mind, the present state of the mind, and the future destination where the mind goes. So even though such words are used, but this exactly is the way of Madhyamika analysis, where the things have independent inherent existence. So when we talk about the source, the present state and the future destination where the mind goes, when we say such a mind, so when we search in this way with regard to the mind, we are not undertaking a search similar to the physical object, because the process of analysis that we do with the physical object cannot be applied with the process of analyzing the mind, because the mind, unlike the physical body, has no shape, no color. So that is actually no knowledge of the actual mind. So therefore, in order to really know about the source, the present state and the future destination of the mind, it is important, first of all, to have a clear understanding of the mind itself. That basically on the conventional level there is a mind which is a source from where it comes, it is a present state, and it is a future destination where it goes. So based on, even though you have this understanding of the conventional nature of the mind, at the same time, from the ultimate point view, that there, this mind has no source, no present state, and no future destination to go. So that is the process of meaning of analysis of the mind. So for one who gives a clear presentation of the view of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, and the unity of the clarity and emptiness, it's important to have a proper understanding of such comments. Such understandings are important because some people say that the Gelugpa's viewpoint is a little bit inferior, which is also not true. And the view that is presented by Tsongkhapa is a kind of common view, common to both the Sutra and Tantra, and what is presented in Dzogchen is the uncommon tantric viewpoint. But in order to fully understand this uncommon view of Dzogchen, it is important that first you should have cultivated a correct view of the common view as presented in Tsongkhapa's text. And without having cultivated such a common path, it is not possible to cultivate the so-called Dzogchen viewpoint, the highest viewpoint. And this is exactly presented in many of the authentic, reliable, great Nyingmaba masters, like the master Khenpo Tsullu or Chudum Sangpo, where he says that you must first have a correct view of the Madhyamika, and in the absence of it, even if you experience the meaning of clear light mind, it will not act as an antidote to removing the root of cycle existence. Because he says his reason was that if merely by experiencing the clear light mind, if it acts an antidote to the roots of cycle existence, then by now we should have all removed the root of cycle existence. Because naturally we experience some kind of, we do have some kind of experience of the clear light mind. So this is a very clear presentation. And And then he in fact made this interesting comment by saying that when I make such a presentation, many of the so-called Dzogchen practitioners might think that this is a new fabrication by a man who has not much understanding, but this is what I truly feel as far as the cultivation of the Dzogchen view is concerned. So this is a kind of digression, but I really feel it is important to develop this understanding. So what is being explained here by Dzogchen Bai is to really give a clear presentation of the correct view and not casting any aspersion to any other mainstream view. And then also there is this question-answer text of Kyudubje, and among these five questions, one question that is being asked to Kyudubje was that there is a question why Tsongkhapa had Lama who followed the Lamde, the Saitya tradition, and then another question was whether this Dzogchen practice is a correct view or not. And then Kyudubje answered that this Dzogchen view is a view that is related to the highest tantric practice, so therefore if you defame and look down upon it, you will fall into a negative state of existence, therefore this is a correct view. And however he said, but still there are people who defame the Dzogchen viewpoint. This is not because of the teaching itself, but because of many practitioners who lead a corrupted view and corrupted life. And in this regard, in his text called Removing the Dispelling, Removing the Darkness of Wrong View, so there he presents opponents of certain Dzogchen presentations. So similarly here Tsongkhapa also is making it very clear about what is genuine practice and what is not. So he's saying that it's important that one should see the actual nature of the mind, and it's not enough that you are able to maintain a thoughtless state, and therefore you should develop a proper understanding of the view as is presented in Madhyamika, and having habituated with those view, philosophical view, and then gradually when you will reach a state where you will be able to cultivate the pre-modic clear-light mind without having to rely on the meditation on channels, drops and so forth. In the self-generation of Guha Samaja, composed by Tsongkhapa, it has a commentary written by Kyudubje to this Nenjol Thakrim. And there he says that in the case of Nyingmapa meditators, there is a method of developing the experience of the primordial view without relying on the channels and drops. So that is the Dzogchen process of practice, and he mentions it very clearly. Then he says there is this certain kind of Guha Samaja practice where you cultivate the experience of the primordial clear light mind by meditating on special positions of the body like the drops, channels and so forth. So in the case of both of these process, the technique is to dissolve the grosser level of the mind and energy, and then so therefore it's important to embrace a practice which is unmistaken and complete. So if it is my view that if a genuine Dzogchen practitioner reads such a Tsongkhapa's text, it will be very very useful for developing correct understanding. And similarly for a Gelugpa also, if you read some of Dzogchen comments like naked liberation, simultaneous liberation and so forth, it will be very useful. Now according to, for example, in the case of five stages of Nagarjuna, he discusses about how to dissolve the grosser level of the mind and the energy and then cultivate primordial clear light mind. So such a technique is taught in Dzogchen also, and in a different way, different form, different technique. So if you are able to study all these various texts and make a comparative understanding and reasoning, and it will be very, very useful for developing conviction. So therefore, when I talk about developing a non-sectarian attitude, it is not, it should not be limited to exchanging pleasantries, but it should be based on proper understanding of these major traditions. However, those who have no knowledge of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, then they would make a mistake. So that's what he says here by saying that they claim that meditation or emptiness means just stabilizing your mind without any basis, without focusing on any object of meditation. So this is, he says, a total misunderstanding of how to meditate on emptiness. And he explains this point by saying that, in fact, if you reflect about the meaning of consciousness, what do we mean by consciousness? If you have no consciousness at that time, then neither will you have a concentration that cultivates emptiness. And on the other hand, if you have a consciousness, then the very definition of consciousness, that it is conscious of something, that it knows something, then you are conscious of something. So you have to accept that there is an object of consciousness in terms of which consciousness is posited. If there is an object of consciousness, then precisely that's the object of meditation of the mind, because object of meditation and object of consciousness have the same meaning. In that case, they would have to accept that even their method of concentration would apprehend signs, thus their approach is not correct. Furthermore, whether something constitutes meditation on emptiness is determined by whether it is meditation founded upon the view that knows the way things are. It is not determined by whether there is any conceptualization vis-a-vis the object. This will be demonstrated at length below. Even those who claim to stabilize their minds without an object of meditation must think first. I will keep my attention such that it does not stray straight toward any object whatsoever, and then keep their attention in that way. After they are focused like that of the mind itself as an object of meditation, they must be certain to fix on this object without staying in any way. Thus, their own experience contradicts their claim that they have no object of meditation. In this way, the classic texts on achieving concentration explain that there are many objects of meditation. The purpose of this meditative basis of stabilizing your mind are as explained above, so you should gain expertise in them. Kamalashila Stages of Meditation explains that the object of meditation of serenity is indeterminate, and Adishasila for the path to enlightenment says it is whatever object or objects of meditation that are appropriate. These statements mean that you are not required to stick with one particular object of meditation. They do not show how to define the range of existing objects of meditation. Next is how should meditate, who should meditate on which objects. As there are various kinds of people, from those with a preponderance of attachment to those with a preponderance of discursiveness, Asanga's Sarvaka level cite an answer to a question of Revata. So thus you certainly should work with the object of meditation. If you are a person whose behavior is balanced or one whose afflictions are slight, then it suffices to give your attention on whichever of the aforementioned objects of meditation you like. It is not necessary to have a particular one, as Asanga's Sarvaka level states. Those whose behavior is balanced should work at whichever object they like, so as to attain just mental stability. This is not for the purpose of purifying behavior. Understand that the same applies to those with slight afflictions. Being dominated by desire or another of those five afflictions means that in a previous life you were fully involved in the affliction, became accustomed to it and expressed it frequently, so that now, even if there is a minor object of desire or another of the five, that affliction arises in a strong and long-lasting form. Balanced behavior means that you were not fully involved in desire and the others in your previous lives. You did not become accustomed to them, and you did not express them frequently. Still you have not recognized that they are false and you have not suppressed them. So while desire and such are not predominant or of great duration, it is not as though they do not occur. Having slight afflictions means that you are not fully involved and so on in desire or another of those five in your previous lives, and you do see their disadvantages, etc. Therefore, with respect to objects of desire and such that are major, many or intense, your desire and such arise slowly, while for moderate or minor objects, these afflictions do not arise at all. Also, when desire or another of those five afflictions is predominant, you take a long time to realize stability. With balanced behavior, you do not take an excessive excessively long time. With minor afflictions, you do so very quickly. As explained, as an answer to a question of Revata, also explains who works on object of meditation for expertise. Revata, if a monk yogi, a practitioner of yoga, is confused about the characteristic nature of all composite things, or confused about the thing called person, self, living being, life, that which is reborn, or the nourisher, he should focus his mind on the objects of meditation for expertise in the aggregates. If he is confused about causes, he should focus on the objects of meditation for expertise in the constituents. If he is confused about conditions, he should focus on the objects of meditation for expertise in the sources. And if he is confused about impermanence, suffering and selflessness, he should focus on the objects of meditation for expertise in depending arising and on what is and is not possible. As this states, you mainly use these five objects of meditation to stop confusion. Which persons should focus their minds on object of meditation for dispelling affliction is also stated in the same sutra. Now, you can use these objects for meditation both for analytical meditation with insight and for stabilizing meditation with serenity, so they are not exclusively objects of meditation for serenity. Still, since some serve as objects of meditation for newly achieving serenity and others are used for special purpose after attaining serenity, I will explain them here in the section on the objects of meditation of serenity. Next is synonyms of the object of meditation. There are synonyms for the images or mental appearances of these objects of meditation explained above. These points upon which the attention is kept or meditative basis of concentration as stated in Asanga's Shavaka levels. Also, that image is called image. It also is called sign of concentration, object in the domain of concentration, technique of concentration, door to concentration, basis of attention, body of internal conceptualization, and appearing image. Know this as synonyms of the image which accords with the object that is known. Next is identifying objects of meditation for this context. Now, from among the many objects of meditation I've explained, on which object of meditation should you base yourself so as to achieve serenity? As stated in the sutra passage cited above, there is no single definite object. Individuals require their particular object of meditation. Specifically, if you are determined to achieve serenity at the least, and if your behavior is dominated by attachment to another affliction, then you need to use a certain type of object of meditation. For if you do not, then you may attain a concentration that approximates serenity, but you will not attain actual serenity. It is said that even if you train with an object of meditation for purifying behavior, you will not achieve serenity unless you do so for a very long time. So how could you ever achieve it by rejecting objects of meditation for purifying behavior? In particular, if you have a predominance of discursiveness, then you definitely have to meditate on the breath. And if you are a person of balanced behavior or a person with slight afflictions, then as explained before, make your meditative base whichever of the objects of meditation explained above most appeals to you. Alternatively, commercialist middle and last stage of meditation follow the sutra on the concentration, which perceives the Buddha of the present face to face, and the king of concentration sutra, and stating that we achieve concentration by focusing on the body of the Tathagata. So there are so many different types of objects of meditation. And particularly if you follow the tantric practice, and then there are so many different types of objects, like meditating on different signs and so forth. As Chankarabha explains in his great stages of the tantric path. Adisha's commentary on his own lamp for the path to enlightenment also cites this passage. In this regard, to keep your attention on the physical form of the Buddha is to recall the Buddha, so it gives rise to limitless merit. When your image of that body is clear and firm, then there is a special intensification of your meditative focus on the field, in relation to which you amass merit through prostration, offering, aspirational prayer, etc., as well as on the field, in relation to which you purify obscurations through confession, restraint, etc. This kind of meditation serves many purposes. As stated earlier in the context extract from the King of Consideration Sutra, it has advantages such as you are not losing your mindfulness of the Buddha as you die, and when you cultivate the mantra path, it heightens deity yoga, etc. The Sutra on the Concentration, which perceives the Buddha of the present face to face, gives a very clear and detailed treatment of these benefits, as well as the method for directing your mind toward the Buddha. Therefore, you should definitely come to know them from there, as Kamala Shila states in his last stages of meditation. Fearing verbosity, I do not write of them here. Consequently, it is skill in means when you seek an object of meditation by which you achieve concentration and also fulfill along the way some other special purposes. How do you use something like the bodily from the bodily form of the Tathagata as an object of meditation? And Kamala Shila explains this in stages of meditation. Of the two ways to do this, merely imagining the Buddha's form and visualizing the Buddha's form as though actually present, the latter has a distinct advantage in developing faith and fits within the context of practices common to both Sutra and Tantra vehicles. Therefore, use a visualized image of the Buddha's form as though it already actually exists. When you seek your object of meditation, the basis upon which you first give your attention, look for an excellent painting or sculpture of the teacher's body and view it again and again. Remembering its features, firmly familiarize yourself with the mental appearance of the object. Or seek your object of meditation by reflecting upon the meaning of the eloquent descriptions of the Buddha's form which you have heard from your guru, and make this image appear in your mind. Furthermore, do not let the object of meditation have the aspect of painting or sculpture. Rather, learn to have it appear in your mind with the aspect of an actual Buddha. Some set an image before them and immediately meditate on it while staring at it. The master Ishida's rejection of this practice is excellent. He says that concentration is not achieved in the sensory consciousnesses, but in the mental consciousness. Thus, the actual object of meditation of a concentration is the actual object of a mental consciousness. Therefore, you must keep your attention on this. He also states what I explained above, that you have to focus your mind on the appearance of the actual concept or mental image of the object of meditation. Furthermore, there are both subtle and gross features of the Buddha's bodily form. It is stated elsewhere that at first you focus on the gross features, and later when these are so solid, you must focus on the subtle. As experience also shows that it's very easy to raise an appearance of the gross features, you must develop your object of meditation in stages, starting with the gross features. An especially important point is that until you have accomplished satisfactory concentration as explained below, it's never appropriate for you to cultivate meditative concentration by shifting your focus to many different types of objects of meditation. For if you cultivate concentration by moving to many dissimilar objects of meditation, it will be a great impediment to achieving serenity. Thus, authoritative texts on achieving concentration, such as Asanga's texts on developers of Kamala Shila's three stages of meditation, explain that when first achieving concentration, you do so in relation to a single object of meditation. They do not say that you shift among many objects of meditation, as is said by Arya Sura. And thus, having first focused on one object of meditation and attained serenity, you may then focus on many objects of meditation. Accordingly, the measure for having first found object of meditation upon which you keep your attention is as follows. Visualize several times in sequence the head, two arms, the rest of the tongue of the body and the two legs. After that, if when you bring your attention to the body as a whole, you can raise before your mind just half of the gross components. Then even without radiant clarity, you should be satisfied with just this and fix your attention upon it. Why? If satisfied with just that, you fail to fix your attention on it and want more clarity instead. Then as you visualize it again and again, the object of meditation will become a bit clearer, but you will not obtain a stable concentration. In fact, you will prevent yourself from getting this. Even though the object of meditation is not very clear, if you keep your attention on precisely this partial object of meditation, you will quickly obtain concentration. Since this then intensifies clarity, you will readily achieve clarity. This comes from the instructions of Ishide. It is of great importance. As for the manner in which the object of meditation appears, you can describe two sets of four possibilities. For various types of persons, it is easy or difficult to have an image appear, and its appearance may be clear or unclear. Moreover, both clear and unclear images may be either said stable or unstable. However, as there is considerable variation, you cannot definitely determine what will occur. When you are practicing deity yoga in the mantra vehicle, you definitely have to establish a clear image of the deity. So until this arises, you must use many methods of developing it. However, in this non-tantric text, if you have great difficulty in making an image of deity appear, you may adopt any one of the objects of meditation presented above and keep your attention on it, because the main purpose is simply to achieve a concentration of meditative serenity. So in this way, you should identify the basis of your focus. Next is the process of focusing your mind. How to focus your mind on the object of meditation has three parts. First is the flawless method. The concentration that you will accomplish here has two special features: vivid intensity and intense mental clarity and non-discursive stability, staying one-pointedly on the object of meditation. Some add bliss to this, making three features. Others add limpidity as well, making four. However, limpidity is included in the first feature, so it does not have to be listed as a separate item. Delight and bliss, which impart a sense of well-being, do occur as a result of the concentration that you will accomplish here, but they are not concomitant with all of the concentrations which are included in the access to the first meditative stabilization. Also, for the concentration of the fourth meditative stabilization, which is said to be the best basis of achieving the good qualities of all three vehicles, is not associated with any physical or mental bliss. Thus, delight and bliss are not counted as features here. While some of the concentration on the formless levels lack highly vivid intensity, there is nothing wrong with presenting vividness as one of these two features. As Maitreya's ornament for the Mahayana Sutra refers to meditative stabilization other than the formless realm. This means that bodhisattvas, except for some powerful bodhisattvas, achieve great qualities by relying on concentrations within the levels of meditative stabilization. Since the development of this sort of vivid intensity is blocked as long as there is laxity, while one-pointed non-discursiveness is blocked as long as there is excitement, laxity and excitement are the chief obstacles to achieving genuine concentration. So if you do not understand how to identify accurately the subtle and coarse forms of laxity and excitement, or if you do not know how to correctly sustain a concentration which stops this once you have identified them, then it will be impossible for you to develop serenity, not to mention insight. Hence, those who diligently seek concentration should master these techniques. Laxity and excitement are conditions unfavorable for achieving serenity. Later I will discuss how to identify these unfavorable conditions and how to actually stop them. Now I shall explain how to develop concentration in a manner conducive to achieving serenity. Here, concentration refers to your attention remaining one-pointedly on an object of meditation. In addition, it must stay with the object continuously. Two things are needed for this. One, a technique in which your attention is not distracted from whatever it had as its original object of meditation. And two, an accurate awareness of whether you are distracted and whether you are becoming distracted. The former is mindfulness and the latter is vigilance. If a lapse in mindfulness leads to forgetting the object of meditation, you will be distracted and will immediately lose the object upon which you are meditating. Therefore, the foundation of cultivating concentration is mindfulness, which does not forget the object. How does such mindfulness focus your mind right on the object of meditation? Once you have at least visualized the object of meditation in the minimal manner as explained above, generate a powerful apprehension of the object that tightly holds it with your attention. And after you have set your attention at a high level, stabilize it on the object without newly analyzing anything. This indicates that mindfulness has three features. One, its observed object is a familiar object, since mindfulness does not occur with regard to a previously unfamiliar object. In this case, the image of a previously ascertained object of meditation appears. Two, its subjective aspect or manner of apprehension is your mind not forgetting the object, as indicated by the phrase "your mind is not forgetful." In this case, it is your mind's non-forgetfulness of the object of meditation. What does non-forgetfulness mean? It is not mentioned in reference to merely being able to remember what your guru taught you about the object of meditation, thinking or saying, "The object of meditation is like this," when you cast your mind to it or when someone asks you about it. Rather, it refers to how your attention is fixed on the object of meditation and brings it to mind clearly without even the slightest distraction. If you are distracted, you lose your mindfulness to the extent that you are distracted. Therefore, after you have set your attention on the object of meditation in the manner explained above, you think, "In this way I have fixed my attention on the subject of meditation." Then without new examination, you sustain the force of that awareness in unbroken continuity. This is the most critical point in the technique of maintaining mindfulness. 3. Its function is to keep your attention from wandering from the object of meditation. Fixing your attention on an object of meditation in this way and controlling it is said to be like taming an elephant. An elephant trainer ties a white elephant to a tree or sturdy post with many thick ropes. If it does as the trainer teaches it, then fine. If not, it is subdued and controlled, stuck repeatedly with a sharp iron hook. Your mind is like the untamed elephant. You bind it with the rope of mindfulness to the sturdy pillar of an object of meditation, such as I explained above. If you cannot keep it here, you must gradually bring it under control by goading it with the iron hook of vigilance. It is not contradictory that the former text likens vigilance to an iron hook, while the latter text compares to a rope. Mindfulness directly and continually fastens your attention to the object of meditation. However, indirectly, vigilance also focuses your attention on the object of meditation, for you depend on noticing actual or incipient laxity and excitement with the vigilance, and then stabilize your attention on the primary object without falling under their influence. Also, as cited above, the Master Vasubandhu says that both mindfulness and vigilance focus your mind on the object of meditation. It is said that you achieve concentration on the basis of mindfulness, and that mindfulness is like a rope that actually fastens your attention to the object of meditation continuously. So mindfulness is the main technique to attain in achieving concentration. Also, mindfulness has a way of apprehending its object that carries a sense of certitude. If while maintaining concentration, you stabilize your mind casually without a solid sense of certainty about the object, then your mind may take on a limited clarity, but it will not have the vivid intensity of certain knowledge, so you will not develop powerful mindfulness. Therefore, certain laxity will be unchecked, and only a flawed concentration will ensue. Those who cultivate just a non-discursive attention without stabilizing their attention on other objects of meditation, such as a divine body, bring to mind the personal instruction, "Stabilize your mind without thinking of any object at all," then they must keep their attention from being distracted and wandering. And this non-distraction is synonymous with the mindfulness that does not forget the object of meditation. But since this meditation is simply the technique of maintaining mindfulness, those who meditate in this way must also rely on a mindfulness that carries the force of certain knowledge. So, Solness is explaining, for example, if you are focusing on, say, the nature of the mind, and as is, for example, explained in the Dzogchen text called Sikshum Nedik, the three words striking at the essence, where there is a line which says Hedevala Sangthalo, which means you will be able to get a sense of the nakatru of the mind if you remain in a, almost like a stupefied form. That means in the beginning, if you allow this openness of the mind to come up, and then ensure that your mind does not chase the object, and rather imagine the mind as a kind of observer, that everything is happening just like that you see things in a mirror, and then gradually you will be able to obtain a potential where you will be able to analyze the actual nature of the mind. As I explained earlier, that is to find the source of the mind, the present state of the mind, the future destination where the mind goes, and so forth.
That's all.